Does my hair look all right? My name is Chris Raymer. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here. I could use some sleep, but I'm delighted to be here. This is going to be good. I feel so tall. Neil, I know, really. We've got you for a couple of hours here this morning, and then we'll eat lunch and have you for a couple more hours. We're going to try not to drag this out too long, so we don't want to wear anybody out. We want to talk to you a little bit about alcoholism, and as always, I'm going to get the chance to visit with some of you in the morning at 10 when I tell my story, so I'm not going to get into that much this morning, but I want to make sure I start by saying that, just like as my brother did last night, and he is the evil one. We just need to go ahead and get that straight now. We're not big book gurus. You know, it's not our way or the highway. I spent years trying to get sober, and I finally got back into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1987. And there was a bunch of people that, for the first time, slowed down and tried to explain what this was about to me. And I started doing the book. It's just like our earlier speaker that just spoke. You know, it's like all of a sudden when this thing starts to make sense, buddy, your life changes forever. And the sad part is we get to see so many alcoholics and addicts out there who never get to that spot because they're never told the truth. And I say, like my brother said last night, nobody intentionally lied to me. No, none of the counselors lied to me. None of the treatment centers lied to me. None of the people in AA lied to me. A lot of them just didn't know any better. And in their attempts to try to help me, they kind of watered the message down. And what happened was it wouldn't work for me. See, as I'm going to talk about tomorrow too, but I'm a real alcoholic. I'm not this little disco drunk, you know, who had a few too many and his wife spanked him and said, "You got to stop drinking." You know, okay, and I go hang out now at the AA meeting. I've been sober for a million years. That's not my experience. My experience was I nearly drank myself to death. And I took a lot of drugs and I damaged myself for that. And I could not stop. And the book explains real clearly. Again, we're going to refer to some pages, and it won't make much sense because it's not going to coincide with the Danish book, but some of y'all, I know, have the regular English, the American version there. But on page 34, it says real clearly, it says, "Assume that you want to stop. Can you stop on a non-spiritual basis?" In other words, it depends on to the point where you have lost the power to choose whether you're going to do this or not, whether you're really one of us. If you can quit because you hit a bottom, and just, I'm tired of hurting, I'm not going to drink anymore, and you don't need a spiritual solution, I'm going to tell you this, folks, you're welcome in this fellowship. You're welcome in AA. Have a nice life. The person that you sponsor, I hope you don't kill. Because this person you sponsor might be like Chris Raymer, who's a real alcoholic, who needs the spiritual experience in order to get sober. Y'all with us? So it's like, I don't want to come across as arrogant up here. I'm very humble and very honored to get a chance to share some of my experience with you. I work in a treatment center. I'm around alcoholics and drug addicts, and I get to watch a lot of people not get this thing. I watch a lot of people die. And I'm pretty passionate about it. There's a way that works. It's called the 12 steps. But in the United States, that message has been so watered down, it's sort of an option. You come to the fellowship, and if you want to, maybe, someday, you can work the steps. And that almost killed me. One of the problems we see in the hospital when the patients come into our hospitals, the big treatment center, and they all come in, and some of them have been to treatment a dozen times, you know. But they come in, and then the first thing out of their mouth is, "I know I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm a drug addict." And the first thing out of my mouth is, "You're a liar." Because once you know you're one of us, I don't mean here, intellectually. I mean here, where it counts. The book says you've got to be convinced to your innermost self. Guys, I called myself an alcoholic all my life. I remember at 21 years old, somebody said, Chris, you drink a lot like an alcoholic. Oh, I am. Poor beat up, you know, it's a sympathy thing. I'm a victim, you know? I don't have to pay my bills. What do you expect? I'm an alcoholic. You don't have to do anything, you know? You can't get a date. Go up next to some good just a poor alcoholic. You wouldn't want to go out with me, would you? And you know, you'll find somebody sooner or later sick enough. Absolutely. You know, I can't. A lot of us have done it. You know, you could use this victim stuff to your advantage. And I can't exactly attest to the fact that the women were particularly attractive, but they were warm. And I'm sure y'all freezing your butts off over here understand that. So, in the hospital, when they come in, they say, I'm an alcoholic. And then you say, no, I believe you're lying. I believe you don't really believe you're an alcoholic. And they get very defensive. They get very defensive. Because they've spent all of this time talking themselves into being an alcoholic. Now they spent a whole bunch of money coming to treatment again. You with it? And they think something's going to be different when they leave. It's not. It's not going to be different. Unless they slow down and truly look at the first step. And I'm going to spend some time this morning really focusing on this first step piece. And there's going to be some of you that some of the stuff I'm going to say is going to make you a little uncomfortable. Okay? Even if it's not okay, it's going to happen. Because here's what happens. The thought of being an alcoholic doesn't make us uncomfortable. The thought of not being an alcoholic makes some of us very uncomfortable. And some of you cats in this room that are not, you may not be alcoholic and addict. You're calling yourself an alcoholic and addict. But the reason you can't identify in these meetings, the reason you can't get comfortable is you're not one of us. I got them quite quick, didn't I? So, we're going to be around, and like I said, we're going to talk for about an hour, and then we'll go smoke and come back in and spend some more time. And we'll, I mean, answer some questions later on in the day so we can talk and you guys can get some clarity around this. Because I don't want anybody to leave this wonderful place where we're getting this chance to share here with questions. And I don't want you to be irritated. I don't want you to get pissed at me. Because I'm the shy and sensitive alcoholic. I am. You guys hear those CDs, you know, it's amazing. Y'all hear these CDs and you think, God, this little guy, he's got to be, I mean, he's tough, you know, and it's like this. I'm not. Y'all see me sitting over here by myself, quiet. That's my natural state. I am the shyest person in this room. Until I start talking about this, until I start remembering, just like our earlier speaker talking about dying out there on the street, and then I get real defensive. Because you think it's your right to come into meetings and share anything you want that's not in this book, that has nothing to do with recovery. You with us? And I'm here to say it is not your right to do that. We have one message. One message. The 12 steps. It's the spiritual experience. And if you're sharing something else besides that, you're wrong. Okay. Everybody in the United States, it's like no matter where I travel around a lot in the States, and I don't get a chance to get out of the country very often, but because I can't sleep. But it's everywhere you go, everybody's tiptoeing, you know? Everybody's afraid they're going to piss somebody else off, you know? Well, this is suggested. This is as rigid as can be. Alcoholics and drug addicts die. Fatal illness. It's progressive. It always gets worse. It's chronic. You will die from it. We have a solution that is guaranteed to work. No exception. But yet we want to treat this like it's an option, like it's just so, it's just suggested. These are the steps we are suggesting you take, folks. It's not a program of suggestions. It's See, if you want what we have, if you want the spiritual experience, if you want a changed life, you're going to have to get off your butt and do something. The patients that come to my hospital, they're in Texas. When they come to this place, they've spent a ton of money and lots of time to get there. I mean, goodness gracious, guys. They're going to get the same results, though, because we don't send people out of that hospital sober alcoholics. We don't send recovered alcoholics out of that hospital. We send dry alcoholics out of that hospital. Dry drug addicts. They'll follow us. We clean them up. We get the chemical out of their system. Other than that, if they don't get connected to groups like this, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and our sister fellowships of Cocaine Anonymous, and Narcotics Anonymous, and Marijuana Anonymous, and Crystal Meth Anonymous, they don't find a home in these groups, they're going to die. We make the phone calls after they leave treatment. We know this. We've got a great success rate there. We pound this pretty hard. But in our arrogance, we think we can do it our own way. You can't. You can't get sober without some humility. You've got to have the ability to be honest with yourself, and you've got to have some humility. Humility to know that you're going to need God to get sober. And how many people do we see every day that are just unwilling to do that? So, this is what we're going to talk about a little bit. I want you to see on the board, I write worse than I thought, but alcohol, see the little 15% on the top. Alcoholism and drug addiction, folks, affects about 15% of us on the population in the United States. In some countries it's a little higher, in some countries it's a little lower. It's a genetic predisposition. Alcoholism and drug addiction is not causal. This will irritate some of you. Alcoholics are not created. They're born that way. Treatment centers hate this when we start talking about this stuff. Because they're making a fortune in the United States telling you that you were made that way. You see, you can't make somebody that's not genetically wired like an alcoholic an alcoholic. The alcohol can exact. Let's say a kid is hurt as a child, is molested, or somebody goes through some trauma in the war or something. That will exacerbate the problem and make them drink or take drugs more than a normal person. Would y'all agree with that? Absolutely. But given sufficient reason, those taps can stop. They can do some good therapy. They can work through it and come out the other side. If you're genetically wired, it's like being allergic to food. Anybody allergic to food in here? What are you allergic to? Milk? Yeah. A lot? Yeah?
And beer.
And beer. Yeah. We probably dated. I know. Milk. If she drinks milk, it'll affect her adversely. Most of y'all in this room don't have any problem with milk. You'll follow us? But if she drinks it, she has a reaction. There's nothing weird about that. It's just genetically the way she was born. Her body will not metabolize milk like mine will. Make sense? Let me ask you a question. This is a tough question. Do you believe that an allergic reaction to milk has something to do with the way you were potty trained? No. Jesus, no. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It would be stupid to think that. You know, the way she was trained to pee had something to do with. And yet we'll sit in therapy groups and talk about this nonsense forever. What caused you to be, it's the truth, my parents caused me to be an alcoholic. No, you know how your parents caused you to be an alcoholic? They did a little pokey pokey, you know? You did a little pokey-pokey and you were born and ba-da-bum. You caught the bullet. Myers and I are identical twins. Y'all can probably see some similarities. But I've been told that I'm the handsomer of the two. Yeah, it's my wife is the only one that says that. But, you know. But see, he and I are alcohol. We got the bullet. My father was an alcoholic. I've got a little sister that's never had a problem with alcohol. A half sister, my older sister, she's never had a problem with alcohol. We can sit down next week. It'll be Thanksgiving in the States, and we'll sit down and we'll have a little turkey dinner, and they'll drink a little mimosa, a little champagne, you know, a little orange juice, and it's, we always watch because they never finish it. You know, they drink a couple of drinks. You go up to my little sister and says, hey, Lisa, are you going to finish your drink? She says, Listen. She says, "No, thank you. It's gotten warm." That's because you drank it too slow. We just can't relate. Bless her. But she was raised in the same family we were raised. Say mom, then say dad, thing. Good Christian home. Everything was cool. No weirdness going on. But she didn't catch the genetic bullet that we caught. And we were luscious from day one. We drank abusively from the first alcohol that we took. And that's the nature of the beast. We are born this way. It is an absolutely diagnosable disease. I'm going to cover this stuff with you pretty quick. I'm going to show you the symptoms of alcoholism. And you can diagnose yourself. If I was talking to a group of adolescents, of kids, of 15, 16-year-old kids, or I would be talking to a group of professionals, you know, doctors, lawyers, or I did a talk one time in a women's prison. There's 500 women. You know, and then when I got, you know, it's like, what am I going to talk to? This is what we're going to talk about. Because it's the same thing. It doesn't matter if you're a woman, or black, or white, or green, or blue. It doesn't matter how old you are. It doesn't matter if you've been molested or not molested. It doesn't matter. This internal stuff is the same in every single one of us. And if you've got these symptoms, you're one of us. If you don't, you're not. Symptoms. See, this is the message. This is what makes our organizations, all of our 12-step groups, so powerful. Because we have the ability to help somebody see their truth. And once you see your truth, you'll finish this work rapidly. See, these steps were intended to be worked rapidly, folks. This is the biggest mistake we see in our fellowships. No matter where we speak, this is the mistake we see. Everybody believes they can take their time to work these steps. But the book just said, we just talked about it on page 34, you must have the spiritual experience in order to recover, if you're truly one of us. Why in the living daylights would we want to take our time to work these steps? And we've got people killing people to this morning, all over the world, in AA meetings, some old geezer sitting in the room looking down over his glasses. No, if you didn't get this sick overnight, you're not going to get well overnight. Wouldn't you? I'm trying real hard not to cuss. That is absolute rubbish. How arrogant of you. How arrogant of you. Many of us in this room have spiritual experiences happen in the twinkling of an eye. And you're going to sit there and tell me that that's not going to happen? It's guaranteed to happen when you work the 12 steps. Joe and Charlie in the States, they came up with a great little book called Working with Others. And it's this great book, The Steps We Took. And it talks about working the steps rapidly. And they give this analogy about like making a cake. How are you going to make a cake? You know, you get the flour and the eggs. Well, you're going to put the eggs in there this week, and next week, maybe 2 months later, add the milk. 6, 7, 8, 9 months later, put it in the stove. What kind of cake are you going to get? Great analogy. You make it the way it's supposed to be done, boom, 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 pop, pow, comes out. Primo. The steps were intended to be worked rapidly. Nobody in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous ever worked the steps slowly. I was in Toronto a year or so ago at a big Cocaine Anonymous deal, and they're using the basic textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that deal, they were saying, because we kept talking about working the steps rapidly, they said, Chris, nobody works the steps until they've been sober 2 or 3 years. You've been sober 2 or 3 years, you'll get an old timer to book you. You know, quote unquote, book you. What? You know, like, book. They'll take you through the steps. It's like, buddy, if I cannot do cocaine for 3 years, I don't need your book. If I can just not drink for 3 years on my own power, why do I need to come to your stupid AA meetings? If you can stay sober on a non-spiritual basis, you're not one of us. Wait on me, damn it. Okay. Over here on the left, I've written 3 words over your fence, buddy. I've written three words: this body, mind, and spirit. This is the three parts. If you look in the front of your books, I noticed in the Danish fourth edition, they still have the circle triangle. In the American edition, they took it out because of copyright problems. Idiots, mullets. Those people in New York better get their stuff together, is all I got to say. But the circle and triangle talks about a three-part program built to treat a three-part disease. I am physically different than normal people. I am mentally different than normal people. And I am spiritually different than normal people. And this is all we have to look at to diagnose ourselves whether or not we're one of us or not. It's just really quite simple. Look at the physical piece. Y'all understand the physical. It's about the phenomenon called craving. Y'all with it? Control. Can you control the amount of alcohol you put in your body once you start? I did date you, didn't I, Ben? No. I can sometimes. I go to happy hour and have a couple of beers and go home. Especially when I was younger. But as I got older, the chances of me doing that was slim. I would sit down with the other guys and they'd say, let's have a couple of beers. And I'd drink a couple of beers and they'd get their coats and say, we're going home. And it's like, okay, that's cool. I'm going to stay here for one more. And then about 2 o'clock, you know, after I've had 12 more, I go on home. And the question is, why can't I control that? See, my body will metabolize that stuff differently than normal people. And the phenomenon of craving, my sister back over here that's allergic to milk, she has a reaction to the milk. We have a reaction to the alcohol just the same. It's an adverse reaction. And it manifests itself in a phenomenon called craving. Normal people don't overdrink. They may do it one time, get sick, and then never do it again. See, they learn. You ask a normal person, you want another drink? They'll say, no thank you. I'm starting to feel it. I said, yeah, me too. You want another one or not? I don't understand that. I'm starting to feel it. It feels great. Let's drink another one. See? These cats are not coming to treatment, folks, because they had a couple of beers. They come to treatment because they tried to drink up half of Denmark. You know what? It's the quantity. It's like the pot. Can you smoke a little pot and be done with it? Can you do a little cocaine and be done with it? No. No. I can understand the phenomena of the craving. Everybody gets on the same page. Doctors, counselors, everybody. Everybody's clear. When an alcoholic starts to drink, he loses control. So the solution is, especially in this state, thank you Nancy Reagan, is just say no. See? Because if you don't drink the first one, you won't get drunk. There's a mullet in Kerrville. This guy's been sober over 30 years, and that's how he shares from the podium. Y'all just remember, if you don't drink the first one, you won't get drunk. It's like, no shit. What? Why didn't I think of that? You mean in 1976, when I was crawling those dumpsters in Houston, Texas to get my dinner, all I had to do was just say no? See, but here's the confusion, because a lot of people can do that. A hard drinker, given sufficient reason, they don't want to crawl back in that dumpster, they can just say no and stop. But once I... The problem is not when it's in my system. We can get everybody detoxed. Y'all understand detox? You're in treatment centers all over this town right now. People are getting detoxed. The chemical is being pulled from their body. So the phenomenon of craving is no longer a problem. It's the second piece, the mental obsession. The obsession of the mind, this is what kills us. The United States right now, every big large pharmaceutical company in the world is working on anti-craving drugs. You with us? Ready? We don't need any more of those drugs. We need an anti-obsession drug. I need something that's going to treat this head. Getting it out of my system is easy. All of us have detoxed, sobered up. The problem is staying sober. I've quit a thousand. How many of y'all have ever quit? Quit drinking. And then started again. Then, you just should have said no louder. The mental obsession is quite clear, but on page 24 it says this, and again the pages won't line up. The fact is that most alcoholics, and I can paraphrase here for our drug addict buddies, most alcoholics or drug addicts, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable, at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. You with us? On page 43, a few pages over, it says, "Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. Must come from God." I'm in AA for 7 years, and nobody will tell me this. In the morning, I tell you, we're going to hit this hard. Because I believe we're misleading the newcomers because we avoid telling them that. I have a mental obsession that tells me to drink. And no matter what happens in my life, no matter how deep the bottom is, my mind is going to forget it. 2 weeks, 2 days, 20 minutes later, my mind says, wasn't that bad. This time I'll just drink one. You know? And then I'm back to the dope. Then I'm back to the alcohol. That's what alcoholism is. If you take this mental piece out, folks, we don't have a disease to talk about. You ask alcoholics. You can't go tonight to an AA meeting. You ask them. You hear them from the podium share all the time. "I got up this morning and chose not to drink." This is no shit. Is that right? Is that right? Because if you can do that, you're not one of us. And you need to stop sharing that from the podium. Did you choose? First step says we were powerless over alcohol. You're telling me that you still have a choice whether you're going to drink or not. If you still have a choice, does your experience show you that you can choose to do this when you want to and choose to stop when you want to? Uh-uh. Then maybe you are truly powerless over alcohol. Can y'all get down to what we're saying here? This thing about choice is the most complicated piece of this. If you can choose to do it, then we have a behavioral problem. But see, there were times... See the little X's? This is Issue Man. I've got some little buttons I'll give some of you later. The little Issue Man on here. Issue Man. These little X's on the outside are issues. Y'all know what issues are, huh? A drama. All of our drama. Right now, today, in this town, in every treatment center in this place, they're talking about these X's. Yeah? Let's talk about the molestation. Let's talk about the rape. Let's talk about being adopted. Let's talk about the abortion. Let's talk about Vietnam. Let's talk about being black. Let's talk about being gay. Let's talk about what? Anything that you think separates you from everybody else, let's talk about that. You with us? We need to stop doing that. Is it important to talk about that? Yes. Does it have anything to do with whether I'm an alcoholic or not? No. It does not. And I know that offends some of you because you've been using that as your trump card for years. "I drink because I was molested." We need to help you find your truth. Because if that's why you drink, we need to do some good therapy around that, and you need to go someplace else. Let me ask you a question. We do this all the time. How many of you guys drank and drugged when you had lots of money? Raise your hand. How many of you drank and drugged when you had no money? How many when you had a great job? Good job. Crappy job. When somebody would you really loved. When you was dating Satan's spawn. See this? Same hands up. Same hands up. So why is it that we think that that's got something to do with our drinking and drugging? Guys, I drank. There's a line in the big book that's so great. It says, "It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon." You remember that line? And what does the guy do in the next paragraph? He gets shit-faced. Yeah, unbelievable. I'm a huge proponent of treatment. I'm a huge proponent of therapy. But I'm going to tell you something, folks. It's stuff we need to all do. Normal people need to do therapy. Good heavens. Y'all down with that? It's got nothing to do with whether I'm going to stay sober or not. The spiritual experience has to do with whether I'm going to stay sober or not. Look at this little guy, this little part over his heart, this little dark spot. That's what we put up there to signify the thing called a spiritual malady. Some of y'all, that may be the first time you've ever heard that term. It's in the book often. I'm not going to open it. The big book talks about, or not, the big book talks about a thing called a spiritual malady. The book says that when that's treated, I straighten out physically and mentally. I suffer from a spiritual illness. It's got nothing to do with belief in God. I've always believed in God. It's got to do with access to God. Big difference. And this spiritual malady, folks, is what we didn't talk about in AA for the first 7 years I was in there. Never heard the term. Let me describe it to you. This is what ties us all together. Lots of different folks in here, different countries, different nationalities, different education, different. Some of you are drop dead gorgeous. Some of you are butt ugly. Are you welcome? This is what ties us all together, folks. Y'all understand the word irritable? Think about it. Think about it before you ever started drinking, folks. Think about you. 11 years old, 12 years old, irritable. Restless. Discontent. Think about it. Bored. No sense of direction. You with it? They call it ADD today. You know, they give you a pill for it, you know? I can't concentrate. Here's a pill. Oh, that's good. That's good. It's a symptom of the spiritual malady. How many of you guys understand depression? Depression. Number one symptom of alcoholism and drug addiction is depression. And we treat it with a pill. You with it? Yeah, we treat lots of this stuff with a pill. No sense of direction. How about the words on page 52 in the bedevilment? Trouble in personal relationships. Including the one with yourself. Think about how you're treating yourself. Some of you guys are mean on you, tough on yourself. Trouble making a living. Yeah, not making money. Some of you guys make lots of money. What are you doing with it? Spending it? Yeah. Credit cards? I had one time. Yeah. Are you being a good steward with God's money is what it's saying. No, absolutely not. Prey to misery and depression. Talks about on page 52, there's one line there that says, we were unhappy. Does that sound familiar? In 17, somebody handed me a bottle of Boone's Farm, and apple wine is just crap. It tastes like hummingbird juice, you know, it's just terrible. And you drink it, and instantly that stuff went away. You could have asked me 30 minutes after I finished that bottle of wine, Chris, are you irritable, restless, and discontent? No. Trouble in personal relationships? Absolutely not. I am Don fucking Juan. Isn't that the truth? See, wrap this up. See, this is what normal people don't understand. They think the alcohol and the cocaine and the pot, they think, oh, that's the problem. If he just stopped drinking, he'd be okay. If they just stopped smoking cocaine, they'd be okay. They don't understand. That stuff's our solution. That's what treats this internal condition. That's why we can't stay sober. You take alcohol and drugs away from an alcoholic or drug addict, you take that away from them, they will get worse, not better. All of us have done that. We had periods of sobriety. My outside world got better. Made a little bit more money, cleaned the house, car got washed. You know, I mean, my outside world appeared to be getting better. My inside world began to disintegrate. And the depression slowly returned, and the boredom and the anxiety. And one day I'm driving home from work, and I'm pissed. You know, the cars are driving too slow, and the radio station's playing nothing but crap, and I'm irritable, restless, and discontent again, you know? And my little mind says, you could probably have one beer. Yeah. I argue with it for about 20 seconds. No, but you've been doing so good. You have 6 months of sobriety. It's just my beer. You pussy. Pull into the 7-Eleven, go to the cooler, pull out a beer, go back to the counter, stop, go back to the cooler, put the beer back, get his juice back. Absolutely. Get a quart of beer, you know, a pony keg. Well, if I'm going to make it one, it's going to be a good one, you know. Listen, watch this, guys. You pull up to the counter, you know, and there's a guy getting a money order and lottery tickets and little lady cuts in front of you, and it's just no big deal. You know, it's like, no, I'm in no hurry. Go ahead. You know, I got a little beer under my arm. I'm ready to, you know, it's like everything's okay. I haven't even drank the stuff and I'm okay. Y'all understand that? If that lady had tried to cut in front of me that morning, I'd have shot her. She's back in line, lady. But now, you know, sit in the car, don't even start it. Crank up the little radio, you know. Oh, listen to that song. That's the best song I ever heard in my life. Instantly, this internal condition goes away. I'm feeling pretty good. You know, life's not so bad. That job is going to be okay. But you know, the sad part is I'm a real alcoholic. And the phenomenal craving kicks in. And so before the afternoon's over, I snuck back across the street to the 7-Eleven and got me a 12-pack to finish the damn job I started. And my sobriety that I had for 6 months is gone again. What got me drunk? The stupid 7-Eleven? No, you go to treatment, that's exactly it. You were triggered. Something, that song must have caused you to drink. That's absolute rubbish. It's just crap. What got me drunk was this head. What got me loaded was this internal discomfort. That's why we must have the spiritual experience. Because when I have this spiritual experience and God gets connected with me, this internal condition leaves. And I get comfortable in my skin and the depression goes away. And I start seeing who I am really as a child of God with some character defects, but I'm not that bad of an egg. You start getting excited about life again. And you start getting a thing called passion back. I'm not talking sex passion. That comes too. I'm talking about the cool stuff, folks. I'm talking about the cool stuff. That's such a great message to carry to a newcomer. And in 1987, those old timers got with me that night after my suicide attempt, and they showed me this, and they explained to me that I had a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession underlying this spiritual malady that must be treated by God. And I said, how in the heck am I going to have a spiritual experience? And he says, you're going to finally, for the first time, finish working these 12 steps. I can do that. I will do that. Life's never been the same. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. Maya's come up and maybe did a little bit about second and third. How about that? How long have we been talking?
Not long enough.
I'm on Texas time. It's in the middle of the night in Texas. You want to smoke?
Yeah.
Let's go smoke real quick. We'll come back. You guys ready to start? How do you say rock and roll in Danish? Hi, you guys. For those that I didn't meet last night, my name is Myers Raymer, and I'm an alcoholic. There's a couple of things I want to mention a little bit, just a little something on what Chris was talking about a minute ago, and I also want to say something ahead of time about what we're doing here primarily this morning, and then again this afternoon. Rather than look at this thing as a lecture on the steps, I guess you could look at it that way, but what I would prefer you to do is look at it as a checklist for sponsorship. Because everybody here that's drawn a sober breath has got a responsibility to extend a hand and try to help somebody else, right? And so the common question that has run through every drunk that I've ever met and every addict I've ever met is, at the moment that I have to go start helping somebody, what do I do? The literature tells us what it is. Strong sponsorship helps us see the direction we're supposed to take. But there's always this anxiety inside, this fear that says, I don't know what to do. I'm not sure I know how to go ahead and carry this guy through this work, you see? And so as we go through this, I hope that we can use this as a checklist to kind of say, okay, I'm okay here, I'm okay here. And when we get to a place where there's a question, something that doesn't jive with what you've been doing, we can talk in questions and answers after this, or we can do it on a one-on-one after this, and we can get everybody kind of squared away so that we're all sort of coming from the same page. The book guaranteed that we would have a common solution for our problem. There shouldn't be 1,000 different ways to do this thing. And I hear this all the time in the United States, people going, you know, there's 1,000 ways to work this steps. Well, I'm going to go a little distance with that. Yes, there's a bunch of different ways to go at this thing, but they should all be sifted through the basic text to show us how to do it. It ought to, in the end, it ought to be all the same stuff that we're telling the new guy. Not all this weird, convoluted, you guys understand it. I've had one consistent question since we've been here, and that's about this thing about working people through the steps quickly as opposed to working them over a year or 2 years or whatever the deal is. And I don't want to get into lengthy debate with anybody about it. I'm just, from my own personal experience and the experience of hundreds and hundreds of men that I've had the pleasure to work with, you can stretch this thing out for a long time. But we have no guarantee when the mental obsession that Chris was talking about earlier, we don't know when the mental obsession is going to rekindle itself, when the spirituality will become so intense. So how many of you guys that sponsor men have seen a guy that you're working with and he's been sober for 6 months and you watch him slowly unravel right in front of your eyes? You watch him slowly just disintegrate. He was doing great a month ago and now he's just restless, irritable, discontent. The spiritual malady has rekindled. He's so uncomfortable in his own skin he can't stand it. The mental obsession is standing right there, waiting to tell him, you know? When I get goofy like that and the spiritual malady hits me, what do I think of? The mental obsession takes me back to a time on the Guadalupe River, which is a real pretty river in Texas, 30 years ago when booze still worked, and I got this little girl right here and a quart of beer right here and the moon's coming up through the cypress trees and I mean, I can see it just like it was yesterday. It doesn't make any difference that I've been beat up and busted by the booze. My head takes me to there, to that night on that river. And so when my guts get tore up inside, I think, you know what? That beer will work again. I'll be able to take a few pulls off that thing and treat that internal condition. That's what Chris was talking about. And so everything, when I do the steps specifically in anything like this, I want to make sure that we're doing it from the standpoint of a sponsor working through a brand new guy. And so when I'm talking up here this morning and this afternoon, I'm pretending for the sake of this deal that you guys are brand new guys. And that we're just working you through the first time. And that way you can see sort of how we go through this thing. And then it becomes easier when you start doing it. If you want to take a year to work the guy through the steps, fine. Do that. But when he unravels 2 months into the deal and he gets drunk, there is another way that I think works better. And I'm going to suggest it like that. Just try that. If you'll go back and look at any piece of history, they worked through this work. In 45 days or less, most of these men were through the work and helping somebody else. They simply did not let them get in trouble. One of my buddies he was talking to just a minute ago, he said, well, you know, some of these guys, including me, I took 6 months to work through the work and this kind of... Well, that's great. What I would prefer to see you do is work it through fast, have the experience, and then go back and catch up on the stuff. Then go back if there's pieces of the stuff that you want to look into, if you want to do an extended third column deal on your four-step stuff, if you want to go back and explore some things, do that. But the experience is already there. The psychic change has already begun and the spiritual malady is held at bay and you can be healthy in your own skin. And that seems to be a healthier way to take a run at the problem.
Yeah.
I think. One of the things that we do as sponsors is we make this work way too complicated. And I don't know how it is here, but in the States, we've made it just bizarrely complicated. Workbooks with 32 pages of information on how to do a fourth step. Most of the men that I sponsor are bottom of the barrel skid row guys. They can barely talk, much less read 32 pages of instruction. You know? Somebody wanted me to start using this study thing that had all of these instructions, and I said, you know, I can't use it if I haven't done it myself, so I'll go try to do it. And after 3 attempts and 2 weeks of fighting my way through the directions of how to do this, I finally set it aside and I said, you know, this Texan is just too stupid for this work. I can't do it. And I began to think, how can I possibly expect my skid row guys that I'm getting to comprehend what I can't do either? And I'm college educated. Well, sort of. I think I remember being there. So this stuff busts down basically to those 3 things. If we're doing step 1, 2, and 3, it busts down to this. 1 is the problem, which Chris talked about just a minute ago. We must understand why we are here and what we are doing. You must be able to transmit that particular information to the guy that you're working with. Because it's only in that information that this man can see what his truth is and be able to diagnose the people that come to him. So I'm pretending for the sake of the example, where's Cole? I always like to pick on, there it is, the birthday guy. Pretending that he came to me this morning and said, would you carry me through this work? The very first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take his little rear right over here and we're going to have a little talk and qualify him, and I'm going to find out what his truth is based on the information that Chris just gave me this morning. I'm going to find out if he's a real deal alcoholic or if he's just a heavy drinker. I'm going to find out if he's a real deal addict or is he a recreational drug user that just got in trouble. There's big differences here, guys. We need to make sure that we understand. Because on the second generation, if I've got a middle-of-the-road guy, the moment I ask him to take action in 3, 4, 5 and on, he's going to crawfish. You see, you sponsored guys like that, haven't you? You girls, you sponsored women like that. I'll do anything you say. Great. Super. They'll do everything they can do sitting just like this. But the moment you ask them to pick up a pen and do an inventory, the phone stops ringing, they stop showing up, they start looking for some hairy-legged guy to go see. They just... I'll do anything as long as you don't ask me to take any action. See? And so, wouldn't it be better for you as an individual, as a sponsor, wouldn't it be better for you to know that going in what you're faced with? If I got me a middle-of-the-road guy, I'm going to be pleasant to him. I'm going to say, I love you, man, and I hope you have a nice day. And then I'm going to dust his ass. I will not spend 2 minutes with that man once I know that he's not a drunk. And I know that drives some of you nuts, but I don't have time to. I sponsor a bunch of men. And I don't have time to be dealing with a middle-of-the-road guy who does not want to be sober. Most of these guys, you have to understand and remember, a whole bunch of people in these rooms, we love them to death, but they are not real alcoholics and they are not real drug addicts. They are just people who drank too much, did too many drugs, and got in trouble. And all they want is the blowtorch off their rear. Understand? They just don't want to be in trouble anymore. And they came. And that's great. I'm glad they're here. But goodness, let them go work with somebody else because I don't have time to do it. Give me somebody that's serious about this stuff. We're all clear on that, I think. So the big difference between AA today and AA 70 years ago was that they didn't mess around either. They qualified their men and women that came in immediately. They qualified. And if you didn't qualify, you were not invited to come back. They didn't really want you in the room. It was not this all-inclusive, all just come and sit. You see? Because it's those men and women that do not belong here that want us to spout all of the opinion stuff as a general rule. They're the ones that want to say, take 2 years to work the work, take this, do this, blah, blah. You don't really have to do that. You know what? I sobered up and I didn't do any inventory. Super. But for the real deal alcoholic, we got to do what the book tells us to do in order to have that experience, right? So if we understand what the problem is on a gut level, we're ready to rock and roll. Okay? We're ready to get going, man. And so the next thing we need to do is I set my guys down. And step 2, we're going to confront this issue of God. And for most of us, that God thing stuck sideways in our craw, didn't it? I mean, some of you came in here embracing God still, but a lot of us, it was just real tough for a lot of us when we got here. You know, we had bad experiences. We had God shoved all kinds of places. And I don't know. And so what I ask guys, I'd say, hey, Cole, I don't need to know all about your experiences in church and all this other kind of stuff. What I need to know is I want you to give me the Reader's Digest condensed version of what you think about God. And Cole will say, I believe in God. I don't believe in God. I hate God. I'm so-so about God. You see, or whatever it is, or a combination of that. But in less than 10 seconds, I have a feeling about where this man is around the issue of God. Why is it important? Because if you can't get your arms around the concept of a spiritual connection of some kind, you will not recover. You will not get where you need to be. You see? Everybody wants to take offense with this stuff. We get a lot of guys out there saying, oh, you know, that's not true. Yes, it is true. Go back and read the work. Read this literature. It's on every page. Everything we do in this work is designed for one thing. To get you focused back on a loving God of your understanding that is going to remove the obsession to drink and do those other outside issues. Right? That's it in its simplest form. If your book was lined up like mine is on page 25 at the bottom of the page, I want to read this little paragraph because it explains where we stand at this point at step two. If you were seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there is no return to human aid, this is the second time in two pages that they've told us this. There is no return through human aid. That means no sponsor is going to save your butt. No group is going to save you. No wife is going to save you. No boy is going to save you. No nothing. Nothing human is going to save you. We had but two alternatives. There's no door number three here, guys. You had two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, drink until you die. And the other was to accept spiritual help. That's the two options. There were no others. You see? So we need to come to grips with that and understand that going in. If the guy you're working with or the woman that you're working with cannot comprehend that and cannot understand that, then perhaps what we got to do is go back and visit step one stuff again to see if they're really if they really understand. Let me tell you something. If you understand on a gut level, that you are a chronic alcoholic and you will die of this disease, there's no greater motivator. If I know that I'm, isn't it funny, guys? Okay, one little side road here. Isn't it funny that if I walked up to Cole today and I said, Cole, I understand the doctor just told you you had cancer. Everybody, including Cole, would take this unbelievably seriously. I mean, he'd be just like, oh God, what am I going to do? And he'd be looking for help and he'd be doing this thing. And the doctors are going to say, hey, I need you to start this chemo stuff and you need to start this radiation. He wouldn't balk a moment. If they said, we want you to do it tomorrow, where would Cole be tomorrow? Taking his medication and doing what he was supposed to do. And yet we take our chronic alcoholism, which kills far more people than cancer, and we trivialize it. We just trivialize it. The girl you're sponsoring, you call her and say, hey, how come you weren't in the meeting last night? Well, there was this guy, and... and it's no different with the men. It's the same kind of thing. We'll think of 1,000 excuses of why we can't do this stuff. The blowtorch is now off my rear. The job's all leveling out a little bit. You guys understand that stuff. We need to get everybody focused and understand the seriousness of the disease, and then we'll be willing to accept, once I know that I'm going to die if I don't do it, accepting spiritual help becomes real easy. Real easy. I'm okay with that, you see? And so then all my job is, in step two is understanding this concept of this God of my understanding. We agnostics, if you've got a guy that's grinding with this God issue, the chapter beautifully explains the process to get somebody through that goofiness so that they can embrace the God of their understanding. On page 46, we're going to read a few little pieces here. I'll read it for you so that we can talk about it a little. On 46, halfway down on our deal, yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that, here it is, as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define and comprehend the power which is God. The huge mistake that most of us make in this deal is that we don't want to believe in God until we have a full-formed vision of Him. And yet, most of us, when we get here, our full-formed vision of God is not too good. We're not real pleased with the old boy upstairs, or the old girl upstairs, or what. You see, we're not real pleased with the whole situation. And so, what we're trying to do is get you to look at and reevaluate that. I find it hugely interesting and sometimes pretty funny that most guys that come in here all grindy about God work through the work and then come full circle and gravitate to and embrace the God of their youth. The God that used to just drive them nuts and now they're okay and everything is fine. Not always, but it happens more times than not that that's exactly what we do. You see? So we're going to qualify this guy, and if you've got a guy that says he cannot believe in anything, any kind of God, in all the years that I've been doing this and in all the men I've sponsored, I've only met one true atheist. I've only met one man who truly did not believe that there was a God out there. Most people are like most of us that believe that there is a God somewhere there. We just don't understand Him or don't like Him, but we know that He's there, you see. But if you have a true atheist on your hand, he's screwed. You're wasting your time. I mean, you're going to need to pray for him and hug his little neck and tell him you love him and hope that he'll do something. And perhaps there's some way that he's going to get this deal, but if there's not much chance of him getting this thing unless he can come to grips with that. I got to tell you, there's this cat one time that I met. This kid asked me to sponsor him. And he's really a wild-looking little guy. He was inked from head to foot. What an ink was pierced. And he just... crazy little guy. And I asked him that thing. I said, Bruce, give me the Reader's Digest condensed version of what you think about God. He said, oh, I love God. I said, oh. He said, I go to church. I said, oh, okay. And we talked a little more, and then we started working. Well, fast forward like 30 days down the road, I'm fighting this losing battle trying to get this kid plugged in, and nothing's working. And so I finally just said, Bruce, I thought you told me that you went to church. And he said, I do. The church is safe. And I went, oh. I don't think that's what they were talking about, brother. I don't think. Scratch Satan, okay? So you got this guy that's ready, pulling straight across the page on 47 in our deal. We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? Here it is. As soon as a man can say that he does believe or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. And every one of you out there know men and women who came into this deal brutalized by the God of their youth, that were willing to submit to a simple process of working this work and then reconnected to this solution that was going to save their bacon. We've seen it time and time again. We're okay there. This thing about step three stuff. We get guys. I talked to a man a minute ago that said it took him 30 days to do step three. 30 days. 30 days to do what you should be able to do in 10 minutes. Step three is a decision. Y'all can read that. My printing is horrible. But step three is a decision. We made a decision that we were going to go ahead and go on with this work. It's the point in time where we make the commitment. We all know men and women that have come into this field and they dance around the rooms and they drink coffee and they joke a lot and they show up and blah, 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 blah. They don't ever get serious about anything. They don't ever really become a part of who we are. They're just around like this. These are men and women who never made the decision. They never made the commitment to do what it is that we're supposed to do. And it takes a commitment. It's like making a decision. It's like making a decision to buy a car. I got a piece of crap for a car. I got to buy a new car. If I never buy the car, I'm just going to keep driving this piece of crap car forever. You see, the way they set the step up was, I first have to come to grips with the fact that the car that I'm driving now is not working anymore. And it's not going to do the job. I have to come to that thing. And then I make the commitment in that decision to go look for another car. You follow me so far? So then we go buy the car. And now we're on the road doing what we're supposed to be doing. But we have to come to that part. Bill Wilson, these guys, go wisely put this stuff just preceding that we need to cover. And they talk about one small character defect in our lives. It's called selfishness and self-centeredness. And here is the rub. And I'm going to preface this whole thing by telling you one thing. If you can come to grips with the depth of your selfishness and self-centeredness, you have a superb chance at getting through this work. If you cannot, I say this, guys, because I came in here thinking that I was Mr. Loving and Giving. I thought I'd been just crapped on by everybody in the universe, but I was kind to the bone, and I was as giving to a fault, and I was... There's Jesus, and then there's me right here, you see? But that's the way inside, that's the way I'm feeling, you see? And I never saw any of the depth of this stuff. What is it? Ego. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs here out of the way. Well, I thought he drew an arrow on it pointing to me. I thought this... Yes. Y'all connected the dots just fine. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs, but it's important to see. I know you guys have read through this stuff a jillion times, but what I'm hoping we'll do is remember now, we're carrying Paul through this thing for the very first time. He's sitting there not knowing any of this stuff, and so we're going to carry him through this thing. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On this basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Does this sound familiar? You see? Any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. How many times have you worked with a man brand new and 10 days later he's telling you how he's going to work the steps? He's telling you what he's going to do with his relationship. He's telling you what he's going to do with his job. I have recited this line so many times that it's a million times. Curious. That book says that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. You haven't done the work. What makes you think you've got any inkling of knowledge about what's good for you at this stage of the game? You arrogant little prick. It just drives me nuts to hear this stuff. We are all selfish and self-centered to the core. And if you don't believe it here, we're going to make a decision. And by the time we get over the fourth step and look at that inventory, it's going to be pointing at you with arrows that are glowing. You are going to know to a depth down here how selfish and self-centered you are. Selfishness and self-centered is the absolute specific reason why so many of us kill ourselves in this deal sober. We get rid of the booze. And there it is. The selfishness and self-centeredness still drives every decision we make. And so we're still out there stepping on people and making all kinds of horrible mistakes in our relationships and with our kids and with our wife. And how many of you guys are married, sobered up, and your wife wished you were still drinking? It happens all the time. Because we're so selfish and demanding as sober individuals or people who are dry from the liquor. We're so demanding. Look at this. They explain it to us. They nail us to the wall on this stuff. This guy's trying to run the show, and he says, what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him.
Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. My wife was always to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pity. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? You know it. Girls, you picked this out a long time ago, didn't you? Man, tell me I'm not telling you the truth. When you see her and you walk over there, you're going to be one of two things. You're either going to be demonstrative and demanding, or you're going to be kind and gracious. But the bottom line is, in your selfishness, is that you want one thing, right? Sure you do. Even a saint like me recognized that. We do that. We want one thing. And we're going to say whatever it takes to get that. And I'll be kind until I find that kindness doesn't work. And then I'm going to be demonstrative until I find that my demanding attitudes don't work. And then I'll do what men do. I'll stomp my feet and heavy sigh until she finally gives in and says, okay. That's what I do. I hate it when I say this. Flip it over the page on 62. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. We talked about this some last night. Don't you think it's curious that Bill Wilson and those guys didn't say, booze and drugs, that we think is the root of our trouble? That is the illusion of everybody that ever came into this deal. It's the illusion of the drunk, and it's the illusion of the drunk's family. We're going to sober up, and then life is going to be rosy. All I have to do is not smell like booze, and she's going to flock to me. I mean, it's going to be sexual bliss. I'm still a selfish, self-centered jerk. And I got to deal with that. That's the character defect that's going to be illuminated in this inventory. And I have to deal with that. Because otherwise, I'm always at odds with everybody because I'm always so insistent that this man and this woman do it my way. That they follow exactly what I want them to do. Yeah, there was a guy in the States years ago that did this little survey, and he asked thousands of drunks, would you rather be happy or would you rather be right? The vast majority of the people surveyed said they would rather be right. They'd rather be right. We've forgotten. Most of us come into this thing and we have forgotten what it's like to be happy. We've forgotten what it's like to just laugh our asses off and just have a great time and know that I don't give a rat's patootie whether this man likes me or dislikes me, or whether he agrees with me or not, whether he likes Bush or hates Bush, whether he likes... I don't care. I'm not going to let this conversation destroy the happiness that I have come to cherish. This book, this program, this God of our understanding gave me back that happiness, and that's all that's important. I want to be comfortable in my own skin. And I will not allow my goofy, self-centered attitude to sweep that away and destroy it. And it will. It will. So we're faced with a decision. In the States, we like to do these third-step things on our knees with another man. Which is a humbling, hugely humbling thing. Most of us, the worst place a man can be, as far as I'm concerned, the most humbling place a man can be is on his knees. I mean, it's just... Do what? Okay. I wasn't going to go there. So what we do is we go through the prayer and we say this prayer. And it doesn't have to be this prayer. It can be any prayer as long as the sentiments are what's stated here in our book. The next thing that I want to make sure, the last thing that I want to talk about before Chris finishes this up, is this thing about the knowing when it's time to do this prayer. In the States, they started this thing where they do these conferences and everybody gets on their knees in the conference and you do a third-step prayer. Old guys, new guys, everybody, it's okay. And the meaning as well, and everybody's cool with it, I guess. I don't think it hurts anything, except that there are people in the room that have not come to grips with the rest of this stuff yet and are not ready to make the commitment, and now we've swept them up wholesale in our decision. And now they feel too embarrassed to say, I'm too uncomfortable about this. They're not ever going to say anything. And so they, for a lot of these men and women, they go through the rest of their AA experience based on an experience that they didn't really have. And so they become what we hate in AA and what we hate in ourselves. They become hypocrites. They become phonies. And they cannot stand with any straight face and talk with any kind of sincerity because they didn't have the experience. It goes back to that stuff we were talking to last night. It's like trying to BS somebody that you know what sex is when you haven't had sex. You just don't know, brother. You don't know. And it makes us a big hypocrite. So you must be ready that the man that you're doing this work with is ready to make the decision to go on with the rest of this work. And I'm very in your face with it, and I'm very vocal about it, and I want to make sure that you understand what it is that we're doing. You're getting ready to ask God to remove these defects. You're getting ready to ask God to change everything about you. The prayer is hugely powerful. Hugely powerful. And it means exactly what it says. And so we don't want to trivialize it, and we don't want to just kind of flippantly, okay, let's do this prayer here and get on down the road. It's the turning point of your life, and it affects everything that you do from now on. So embrace it if you're ready, and if you're not, if you're with a sponsor that wants you to do this and you're not ready to do it yet, just tell him, I'm not ready to do this yet. I don't really understand. I need to do some more stuff. But you dictate that, not your sponsor. You dictate that. It's your recovery. We clear? We cool? 99% of the men and women you sponsor will say, okay, I'm ready. They'll do this stuff. But you'll have some that will say, can we wait until next week to do it? That's their privilege to wait if that's what they want to do. But I would much rather have a man come to me and say, I'm ready to do this. We get on our knees and do the prayer. Than I would to always be scratching my head and wonder, did I push that little guy? When he twists off and gets drunk later because he can never internalize what he just did? Am I going to have to shoulder the guilt and responsibility for what I did? Yeah, to some extent, yes. It's important. I think I'm done on that, Christian. Do you want to flesh that out, somebody?